downtown recovery. Here you see the downtown as the city's heart, and Blackstone, a main north-south drag, as the spine, residential areas as the lungs. She continued on through the parks and trails and bike lanes and gathering places that would, as she put it, give life to the city. There was a bittersweet aspect to Fresno's effort because it involved, literally, bulldozing away a previous generation's attempts to save this same downtown. In the early 1960s, Fresno commissioned the famed modernist landscape architect Garrett Ekbo to design a modern, art-adorned, car-free pedestrian strolling mall through the heart of the city's downtown. For a while, it was celebrated as a work of both artistic and commercial genius. But then, as happened with so many other pedestrian-only, no-car malls across the country, the business and street life of Fresno relocated to the sprawl malls of the northern suburbs. The tracks of Fulton Street, once beautiful and busy, were still adorned with their original statuary, but had precious few customers. To save its downtown, Fresno decided during Swearengen's time on a step that had been applied in a number of other cities as well, namely bulldozing the expensive pedestrian model and reopening the streets to cars. It was in Greenville that we'd first been introduced to the idea that allowing cars back into a downtown on comparatively narrow streets rather than huge speed-through boulevards could actually be a formula for modern urban revival by making stores and restaurants more easily available to more customers. Fresno was the second city to have this kind of pedestrian-only mall, explained Craig Sharton, whose business card identified him as the publican of Peeves Public House and Local Market, a holdout in the quasi-ruins of the old Fulton Mall. The first city was Grand Rapids, Michigan. We'll be the 100th plus to dismantle it. All of the evidence, he and many others said, had swung to the Greenville, Sioux Falls, Allentown, Riverside approach of controlled car access to a rebounding downtown. How will we know if this plan is working? Ashley Swearengen said during one of our meetings. Look down on our historic Main Street. She indicated the blocks along the Fulton Street Pedestrian Mall. And you'll see the greatest stock of historic buildings anywhere in Central California. We've got good bones. The problem, she said, was that most of these buildings now stood vacant because the idea of being blocked off from car traffic no longer made sense. The city invested millions in public art, so no one wanted to take it out, she said. But by the 1980s, the Los Angeles Times was already writing about the mall as a ghost town. By 2013, she had convinced the city council to support her idea of reopening the mall to car traffic, Fresno's version of Knox White's gamble in tearing down a highway overpass. Based on that vote, she said, investors had already begun to come in. I told Ashley Swearengen, Craig Sharton, CEO of the Downtown Fresno Partnership, Aaron Blair, and others I met in Fresno, that I was still unconvinced by the comeback story. Then Jake Soberall took me on a drive and asked me to imagine what was not there yet. Where is Fresno on the arc of recovery? I asked him. I drive down Van Ness, he said, referring to a main downtown street, to work each day. And if you're a person from outside, you probably think, well, you've got some historic buildings here, but it's a pretty crummy downtown compared to what's happening in other places in America. I told him that was pretty much what I thought. But when I drive down that street, he said, I realize that my friend Joe is doing a project there, and someone is doing a project there, and this building is under lease, and that building is about to be reopened. And I look at it and think, it's done. I mean this earnestly, he added, and I'm not being flippant. Downtown revitalization in Fresno is done in terms of making the decisions. Now We just have to let it happen.
We first heard about the Kepler Neighborhood School during a conversation at Peeves Pub in downtown Fresno. That was not unusual, as Peeves is the place to go when you want to know what's happening in Fresno. Or was. Much to our deep dismay, and certainly even more so to Fresnans, Peeves suspended operations about a year and a half after we first visited. Peeves was in the Fulton Mall, which was about to undergo a complete facelift. Peeves' proprietor, the seemingly omnipresent Craig Sharton, became the manager of the Fulton Mall renovation project. When Jim finished talking about beer, I asked Sharton about local schools, and he pointed us to the bar to chat with Steve Skibby, who was pouring beers that night. Skibby and his wife Sheila and their two young children live in the nearby downtown Lowell area of Fresno, a diverse, progressive-minded neighborhood that is one of those driving Fresno toward what local activists hope will be its best possible future. That is how I found the Kepler Neighborhood School, a K-8 charter school named for the 17th-century German mathematician and astronomer Johannes Kepler. Sheila Skibby founded the school with Valerie Blackburn in 2013. The two educators huddled for almost 3 years over research and charter writing, seeking teachers, a principal, students, a building, and a board, and persuading parents, the downtown neighborhood, and unanimously the Fresno School Board to approve the Kepler Charter. Kepler's mission began with a deep commitment to service learning, which means, as the name suggests, combining community service with regular academic instruction. The Kepler community sees the school as an integral player in building civic and cultural strength in downtown Fresno, and they see its young students becoming self-aware citizens who can help make that happen. How do you do this? A key ingredient is an understanding of the community where the school is located, plus concrete ideas of how the school will integrate itself and its curriculum into that community. Within the school's walkable radius are the places in downtown Fresno that have become satellite classrooms of Kepler. For example, the Fulton Mall, home to Peeves, for its makeover, the Lowell Community Garden for its urban agriculture, the Mural District for arts, burgeoning tech development, and makerspace, City Hall, the trendy and bohemian Tower District for its new urban culture and performances, the school's home turf of the Lowell neighborhood for exposure to its urban challenges, read, crime, gangs, drugs, slumlords. Teachers in each grade build academics and real-world skills into special themes and projects within the neighborhood. That year, the eighth graders' focus was called City Makeover. Students worked with historians to understand the plans for a full-circle evolution of the Fulton Mall from a downtown street to a pedestrian street and back again. They worked with engineers and architects to learn about construction and renovation for the street and its historic buildings. They learned about communicating with city administrators and politicians and the politics of change. They learned how to write business plans for current and future commerce. And they confronted some real-world episodes, such as when the beloved Peeves Pub shuttered. The fifth grader's theme was called Cast Iron Chef. Principal Christine Montanez told me how the students made garden boxes and learned about seed selection and planting seasons as part of a broader understanding of agriculture and food supply. She also described a series of disappointments and problems the students addressed. An unanticipated freeze killed their newly planted seeds, an irrigation pipe broke, and a roach infestation emerged. Kepler takes its students out to serve the community and brings the community in. Students stage drama performances for a local community care center. They host local art hop nights to show off their own creations. They go out to the makerspace Idea Works to learn woodworking. Kepler invites Revolution Foods to help teach the elective course Chefs and Seams, read Home Ec. It sends kids for sports to a gym from the World Impact Religious Organization. Kepler fourth graders built owl boxes for Critter Creek, and Animal Rehabilitation Center, which returned the favor by bringing owls and eagles to the school for demonstrations. The students marched the several blocks to City Hall to meet with then-Mayor Ashley Swearingen on National School Choice Week, and then spoke about it on local radio. Kepler draws students from all over the Fresno area, but it especially wants to draw in neighborhood kids, says Montanez. In many of the startup schools I visited, I heard about the challenges of getting the school population going. It requires a lot of trust from parents to be first on board with a new school. The student population of Kepler started with some 200 kids. And then, as with many startup schools I visited, Kepler's popularity exploded. Kepler more than doubled its enrollment to 465 by the 2017-18 school year. In the spring of 2017, Kepler moved from a modest rented space in Cornerstone Conference Center to a renovated 1913 historic building, originally a car and truck dealership just a few blocks away. The new structure has much more space, a beautiful facade of arched windows, wooden columns, and a terracotta tile roof. It took me two visits to warm up to Fresno. On the first, which was really just a scouting trip, all I could see was the sketchy urban activity outside our downtown hotel. Jim started calling it a crack hotel. That was a little harsh, but you get the picture. Nonetheless, we decided to return. We booked a different hotel for our next visit, which we arranged to coincide with Fresno's Rogue Festival. The popular Fringe Festival started in 2002 by local dramatist, director, and impresario Marcel Nunes. Along our way by then, we had been to art hops, local theater productions, plein air festivals, concerts, outdoor plays, parades, musical performances, and one-off exhibits. We had visited artist-in-residence programs like the one in Eastport. We learned about shared art studios and makerspaces, like the ones in the Franklinton neighborhood in Columbus, Ohio. We had taken self-guided tours of murals, sculptures, and galleries from Sioux Falls to Greenville, Rapid City, Ajo, and Holland. And we would later take others in Laramie, Dodge City, and Winters, California. We had no idea what we were in for with the Rogue Festival. On opening night, the Rogue audience was lined up early along the sidewalk in front of the Old Tower Theater. People were clearly primed for the pregame show of fire breathers, men on stilts, and artists who walked the line handing out personal postcards featuring their work. Opening night was a teaser where some 30 of the festival's performers, out of more than 70, gave two-minute shotgun glimpses of what was to come later. The popular MCs Jonathan Hogan and Amy Quarin appeared in a revolving collection of costumes, monitoring the show with stopwatch precision, walking out to slow clap each act off the stage at exactly second number 121. Some of the performers were Fresnans, while others came from everywhere. This was indeed art on the fringe, with a savvy audience cheering on the artists who were pushing their own edges. A few days earlier, we had met with Rogue veterans Jonathan Hogan and Heather Parrish at a brew pub a few blocks down from the theater in the Tower District. They toured us around the festival venues, from gallery spaces to coffee shops, and talked to us about the importance of the Rogue Festival, the Tower District, and the art scene in general to Fresno. Sure, the festival and the arts had revitalized the neighborhood and brought in a lot of business, but what the arts have done for the culture and self-image of Fresno may be the most important part. The arts had become a reason for creative people to come to Fresno and for those already there to reach for their own dreams. There was now license to be creative in Fresno. How does this work? It starts with real estate. A nice house in Fresno cost a few hundred thousand dollars rather than the few million as in Los Angeles or San Francisco. In Fresno, you can do anything. Start a family, start a business, start a school, start a studio, because you can afford it. And being out of the shadow of the coast cities, Fresno was free to do things for itself and cultivate its own homegrown, edgy personality. The Tower District is the Bohemia of Fresno, said Parrish. And Fresno is the Bohemia of California.
On each visit, we checked in with a tech company called Bitwise Industries, located in the Mural District of Fresno's tattered but struggling to recover downtown. We were intrigued by its story because of the way it shed light on conditions distinctive to Fresno and the Central Valley of California, but also about the ways in which it reflected trends we've seen in every corner of the country. The similarities involved Bitwise's basic setup, which resembled tech promotion and startup efforts we'd already seen from South Carolina to South Dakota and including points in between. The familiar elements of the tech fostering package include a physical space where startup companies can get going at low cost and with shared facilities, the location of that space, typically in a historic downtown area, as part of a larger downtown renewal effort, courses on relevant skills from coding to accounting to marketing, connections with more established local businesses, plus financiers and customers, and collaborative agreements with research universities, community colleges, and even K-12 schools in the region. Bitwise is a normal tech-promoting effort in these ways. Jake Soberall, its co-founder and CEO, said he didn't like the term incubator, since many of the businesses he worked with were already well-established. Still, for descriptive convenience, the company's efforts resemble those of incubators elsewhere. Bitwise was also illustrative of its city and region and about the challenges of trying to create a tech economy with the high-wage jobs and spin-off business stimulation that presumably means in a place far removed from the dominant tech centers of the East and West Coast. Soberall and his Bitwise co-founder, Irma Olguin Jr., described their organization as the mothership of technology in the Fresno region. In practice, that means that their parent organization combined several of the startup functions, sometimes dispersed among different groups. The company's hashtag Fresno component offers low-cost, $39 per month, tech-equipped workspaces for individuals or small teams. Its GeekWise Academy, a coding and tech skills school, is developing an intriguing range of specialized programs. This is the most significant thing we do, Soberall said of his courses for adult learners. Most training programs take people from being out of the line and put them in the back of the line, he said. They get people all trained up for a poor job. We want to get them ready for the front of the line, for jobs in the highest growth industry on the planet, by which he meant anything requiring coding skills. Its Shift 3 Technologies does contract tech projects for firms in the region and elsewhere, employing local developers, designers, and marketers. And its headquarters building in the Mural District contains separate offices for more than 24 tech firms. In 2016, the company opened a new, much larger office and classroom space in a long vacant building it had remodeled in Fresno's historic downtown. Soberall said that some 40 tech companies will be housed there, along with more workspaces, classrooms, offices for lawyers or accountants or other allied professionals, etc. For now, the focus is on the challenge of building a tech industry in a part of the country with an agricultural-centric economy, no major nearby research universities, and a reputation as a place that ambitious young people move away from rather than return to. But what could be the business base for a tech economy that was more than a 3-hour drive from either Los Angeles or San Francisco, and thus would lack all the place-based advantages that came automatically to firms in San Francisco, Boston, or New York? I asked Soberall, how can you fight the trend towards the concentration of national and global talent in a handful of hyper-expensive but also hyper-productive big centers? He had two replies. the first of which was that the global centers and the regional ones could prosper together, the latter using their advantage of such dramatically lower operating costs. The per-person total cost of a very happy mid-career developer here is $80,000 to $100,000, Soberall said. That's half or less than half of the cost in the Bay Area or other big tech centers. If we can get a critical mass of people here in Fresno who are competent and capable, national and global companies will choose to expand their operations here. The Silicon Valley and Boston and Portland will continue to grow. And so will Fresno and Des Moines and Wichita. Software and tech have not been a zero-sum game. You could think of this as the outsourcing part of the Bitwise Greater Fresno Tech vision. The other part was more intriguing in that it matched the observation we've heard in most successful-seeming cities across the country. That is the insistence on knowing who we really are in a given city or region, whether that was voiced in City Hall or public libraries or schools or about downtown design or infrastructure, and choosing strategies based on an honest assessment of an area's advantages and handicaps. What Fresno really is the regional capital of one of the world's most important agricultural areas. The economy is global, but significant strengths are local, Soberall said. Industries tend to develop in a regional way. He went on to argue, first, that agriculture involves many of humanity's most important challenges, starting with sustainability in all its aspects. Second, that agriculture was still relatively behind in applying modern data tools to its operations. And third, that therefore tech companies in the Central Valley had an opportunity to become the leaders in a field of ever-increasing importance. Soberall told me, my guess is that 5 to 10% of the tech need of the farming industry is now being met, as compared to the flood of tech talent and investment capital that have vastly oversupplied the needs of the financial service industry or online commerce. He remarked, you could build a technology industry in Fresno based on that alone, not to mention the worldwide need in agriculture. What kind of unmet need? I spoke with Derek Payton, a programmer who is CTO of a company called Edit LLC, which is based in the Bitwise building. He pointed out that modern farmers had an abundance of sensors on soil moisture, sugar levels in fruit, you name it, but relatively poor tools for combining or analyzing data. You could contrast this with a hospital's intensive care unit with displays of many important data all in one place. Payton's company was working on software to convert data from a wide variety of sources into a standard format so that it could be used for a kind of dashboard display. You think of high tech, you don't think growing food, Payton told me. You think Bay Area, self-driving cars, devices to make daily life easier. But we've got a lot of farmers here with a lot of data they don't know what to do with. It can make a big difference to collect the data and put it in usable form. And what would be a realistic ambition for Fresno, I asked Payton. A realistic and positive scenario, he said. It would be when you think of tech in California, you'll think of the Bay Area, L.A., San Diego, and Fresno. There's definitely strong tech potential here.
At the north end of Fresno is a very different kind of school, ambitiously named the Center for Advanced Research and Technology, CART. This school began with a glimmer of an idea that we could do better at educating students in the middle who often fall through the cracks, and especially those who have trouble finding their way in a more traditional American high school environment. The 1,300 CART students, 11th and 12th graders, come from 15 schools around the city of Fresno and the smaller, more affluent adjacent town of Clovis. They spend half the day in their home high schools and the other half at CART. Rick Watson, who is CART's CEO, yes, CEO, not principal, said that in 1997, a group of educators and business and community leaders pulled together to imagine and assemble a career-track high school with a solid traditional academic footing, an infusion of technology, and echoing Kepler, a spirit of real-worldism. At CART, students choose from an array of courses that offer career-specific labs in fields from forensics to game design to law and order, robotics, biotech, engineering, business and finance, environmental science, psychology and human behavior, and many more. Each lab is taught by a team of three educators who have work experience in their fields, from TV to graphic design to pharmaceuticals. Teams of students attack real-world projects from their fields. I heard about cloning carrots, making movies, designing online games, and building toys. CART takes advantage of its location among the high-tech business and agricultural efforts in the San Joaquin Valley. There are field trips to agriculture expos, aviation companies, and dairies. Students do internships or projects that take them to hospital operating rooms, senior centers, wildlife refuges, and the tech incubator Bitwise, which, in turn, offers them exposure to dozens of hot new tech companies. CART's home is an airy former factory of the Danish water pump manufacturer Grundfos, whose U.S. birthplace was Fresno. The broad halls, big staircase, two-storied common area, and big windowed classrooms create a space where kids can move freely and loosely. Banners depicting heroes like Eleanor Roosevelt, Bill Gates, George Lucas, Sandra Day O'Connor, and John Glenn decorate the halls. I was talking for a while with Watson and the Dean of Curriculum and Instruction, Bethany Grupa, inside an all-purpose meeting room that looks out onto an open student gathering area, when a few students serenaded us with an impromptu and respectable rendition of the Eagles' Hotel California. I toured the school with one of CART's enthusiastic student ambassadors. Harut Berian is Armenian, part of Fresno's large immigrant farming population, which began arriving in the late 19th century. His home school is the Bullard High School in Fresno. He's on the biomedical track. Like many CART students, Harut has laid out his plan to attend community college for a few years before transferring to a four-year college. He dreams of becoming a pharmacist. CART's hallmark career track program couples with a mission that CEO Rick Watson considers equally important, developing the students' soft skills of confidence, self-esteem, and teamwork. This took me back to similar conversations at the Finnessy Fisher STEAM School in Greenville, which encourages the same kind of focus. There's nothing soft-sounding about CART's approach to soft skills. Teachers and administrators use terms like take risks, encouraged to fail, get back on the horse, and no one is expendable. In the team-based projects, a student who lets the team down badly can find himself demoted from responsibilities or even off the team. While touring the school with Harut, I noticed a group of about 10 people sitting around a table in the hall. I assumed they were visitors like me, who had also come to see the school. Wrong. This was a group of students from the multimedia track, dressed, better than me, for professional dress day, meeting side by side with their equally young-looking teachers and mentors. I sat with the group while the students talked through progress on their 10-week-long project, the production of a 7-minute video. This year's theme for the video teams was science fiction. The essential questions of their assignment. How do imagination and technology contribute to our understanding of science, nature, and the human mind? How does the exploration of science and nature encourage us to dream of a better future? The soup-to-nuts tasks include writing an original story and script, casting actors, directing, filming, adding special effects, editing, promoting, and presenting the end product. The final package includes a documentary of the entire video production with its many high and low points. A few days later, Jim and I watched videos of about half the previous year's 22 productions. The most remarkable part to us were the student-produced documentaries that accompanied each film. The students spoke of how doing this intense work taught them about perseverance and teamwork, satisfactions and handling frustration, just the kinds of hard-to-measure soft skills that designers of education programs would wish for. Just as students from the AVID program in San Bernardino's Cajon High School reflected on the life-changing program and the attention from their teachers, the CART students sounded similar. The following words are from a CART graduate of 2014, a young woman who studied on the economics and finance track. Here is an excerpt from a blog post she entered on the CART website. Graduation is coming up in a few short weeks, and I can't believe that I'm about to be done with high school. In fact, it's hard to believe that I survived these past 4 years. I think I only survived these last 2 years because of CART. Attending CART was one of the best decisions that I have made in my life. While at CART, I've been challenged and pushed to become good at what I aim to do. I've struggled and stressed through projects, but reflecting back, I can honestly say that I have enjoyed all of it, even if I didn't believe it at the time. This is my second year as a student in the Economics and Finance Lab. This lab and the teachers in it have helped me in more ways than I can count. I feel that I have gained so much knowledge in the business world that I am ready to be a part of it. During these 2 years, I have put together financial portfolios, gone on 2 internships, created a nonprofit, and am currently creating a for-profit business. None of these are things I would be able to do, especially not with such skill and precision like I have been able to, if not for CART. My teachers and this learning environment have provided me with plenty of real-world experience that I feel I can jump into the business field now and survive.
In late March 2016, many of Fresno's leaders gathered for a State of Downtown gala to talk about plans for the Fulton Street Mall. Mayor Swearingen was there, as well as the president of Fresno State, Joseph Castro, Aaron Blair of the Downtown Fresno Partnership, and others. The event was held in the downtown's historic, then run-down, now being renovated, Pacific Southwest building, and drew a sold-out, standing-room-only crowd of many hundreds. The centerpiece of the event was a video about the city's past and its future ambitions. "We are unapologetically Fresno," the announcer said near the beginning. "We are changing minds one visitor at a time." Unapologetically was, of course, the key word. It's not one you'd hear in Cambridge or Brooklyn or Santa Monica, but it's one we had become hyper-attuned to, from South Dakota to Mississippi to now the Central Valley. The Rebuild Fresno movement has unapologetically recognized the challenge of the city's self-image and determined to blast right through it. I thought as I watched the video about what we had heard from people in Fresno on exactly this point. From Ashley Swearingen, the mayor. "As mayor, I've run across this self-image question all the time. There are people who know every past failure of Fresno, and they can recite them routinely whenever we are discussing something new. But the generation now in their 20s and 30s does not reflect a defeatist attitude like some of their parents. And the grandparents also don't have a defeatist outlook. They remember the city when it was on the cutting edge. And the younger ones assume they can get there again," she added. To illustrate the generational split, the mayor mentioned that during a debate on Fresno redevelopment plans, a man in his 20s had tweeted a proposal for a new drinking game. Every time a middle-aged Fresnan responded to new proposals with a lamentation about crushed dreams in the past, the younger Fresnans would take a drink. From Aaron Blair, who is from Ohio and had done urban development work in Florida and Georgia before being recruited to come to Fresno. "When we came to look at Fresno, I also thought it had this little chip on its shoulder, which I actually like. Cleveland has some of that same feel to it, and so does some of the South. This is a situation I'm familiar with and like coming into. You want to see if we're good enough? Just watch. And I was excited by all the potential I saw. Christopher Gabriel, a longtime stage actor turned local radio talk show host, grew up and spent his early working life in big city America. Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, New York, the Twin Cities, and came to Fresno after a stint in the also-revitalizing town of Fargo, North Dakota. There was an energy and vibe in the room that was unmistakable, he said. It wasn't just some feel-good moment. I've been to enough cities, I've seen enough of them rise from the dust, to sense that this was real. It was, let's do this. Let's create everybody's collective legacy for the Central Valley. Sometimes people will hear me say that and react, oh, you've just got this youthful energy about Fresno. I'm in my 50s. I didn't move here just to go up to a larger market or get more money. I moved here because I saw a city on the move that has remarkable diversity, culinary and cultural and artistic. People here have been jaded. But if you can get outside yourself, you see an unpolished gem. And once more from Jake Soberall. What's the main thing making Fresno better? I believe that we have a generation of young people who do not want to adopt their parents' view of this place, or the world's view. That is really, really significant. Increasingly, we're able to count among those young people some of our most talented, whereas before, Fresno was famous for losing those people. Soberall said that a number of local groups were interested in changing the prevailing views of the city, from the mayor to the Downtown Alliance. He supports those efforts, he said. But the group of people involved in changing what others think about the city is smaller than the group of people who say, I don't care what you, Dad, might think about Fresno. There is real data that makes me excited about what I can do here. That group is growing quite large, and the decisions they make are driven by data. They think, I can open a restaurant here. I can get a house here. I can build a company here. I don't care that you think Fresno sucks. Winters, California. A handful of times during our travels, we landed in a city on a hunch or a challenge. That was the case in Columbus, Mississippi, when high school English teacher Thomas Easterling enticed us there to compare his Mississippi School for Mathematics and Science with the acclaimed Governor's School for the Arts and Humanities, which we had seen and written about in Greenville, South Carolina. We took him up on the offer, and it worked out well. Both schools were amazing. Both towns were surprising. Our first visit to Winters, California, one of a pair we made before and then after our time in Fresno, began similarly. At a conference of California civic leaders at the historic Ahwahnee Hotel in Yosemite Park, we met Woody and Rebecca Friday, both longtime teachers and civic activists in Winters. Woody was a former city council member and mayor, Rebecca, a leader at the public library. They talked about their town and enticed us to visit. This is a town that is really trying to use every tool it can think of, Woody said. Before we arrived in Winters, we wondered whether the small Northern California town would live up to the Friday's challenge and be real enough to illustrate the economic and cultural trends and tensions of the era. In photos, its downtown looked almost too perfect. The storefronts were restored brick structures from the classic era of American Main Street design. Each springtime, the town held the month-long plein air festival for artists. On one corner of the principal downtown intersection, where Railroad Street met Main, stood the Buckhorn Steakhouse, a frontier-themed fine dining establishment that drew customers from across California and beyond. Across from it was the Puta Creek Cafe, named for the oak-lined creek that twists around the town, and looking as if it had been taken from the set of Twin Peaks, or even Happy Days. The signs on its windows advertised lunch, dinner, homemade pies. On another corner was a public park with benches and shade trees and a bandstand gazebo. In the distance, past the creek, stretched vast stone fruit and nut tree orchards, walnuts, almonds, apricots, plums. Up the block on Railroad were the offices of the Winter's Express, a still viable local weekly for a town of some 8,000 people. The Express was founded in 1884 and, as we discovered when we visited the town, had an office crammed with manual typewriters and other artifacts of a bygone era of publishing. A big pool table dominated the newsroom, and a game was in progress when we walked in. A few buildings down the other direction on Main was the Palms Playhouse, occupying a gay 90s-era opera building and offering live music performances several nights a week. Within a two-block range were two separate storefronts run by family-owned wineries, coupled with artisan cheesemakers. With all its first-impression charms, would Winter's be more than a copycat extension of the wine country an hour to the north, or a too-polished day-trip destination for the food and tech folks from San Francisco, barely 90 minutes west? John Pickerel, a restaurateur and entrepreneur who moved to Winter's to found the Buckhorn Steakhouse in the early 1980s, answered the question before we posed it. The playhouse, the restaurants, the fancy bike shop, the wine outlets, they can attract people, he said. But the foundations of the local economy, he said, remains agriculture. This town looks and feels like a Midwestern town that just got dropped in California, he added, and it's one of the highest producing agricultural counties in the entire world. We're just off the charts. Immediate evidence proving this point is the vast packing house of the Mariani Nut Company, one of the world's leading walnut and almond producers and distributors, easy walking distance from the center of town. At the time of our first visit, the viability of the area's agricultural base was newly called into question because of the state's dire five-year drought. When Governor Jerry Brown was imposing mandatory water rationing on households across the state, and when city governments were jacking up utility rates and penalties for water waste, long-standing policies that favored farmers' claims to water became bitterly controversial. Even the calculations of how much water went to farms became embattled. If you measured all the moisture that fell on the state or was drawn from the ground, farm use would amount to 30 or 40%. If you counted only purposeful human use, for drinking water, in industries, for irrigation, or other purposes, leaving out the flow that goes through rivers straight to the sea, the farming share becomes much larger. By any calculation, more water goes into agriculture in the state than into households and factories combined. The nut orchards of Winter's and its vicinity epitomized the tension. Almonds and walnuts are extremely valuable cash crops because of rising demand around the world, notably China and the rest of Asia. They are also more water-intensive per pound of output than most other crops. And the water to produce them was, especially in the drought years, drawn heavily from underground aquifers, whose levels were declining at an alarming pace. Thus, at that moment in Winter's, the farmers wrestled with the future of their industry. Downtown businesses strove to keep it viable and attractive as a destination, and civic leaders, educators, and artists worked to preserve its heritage and strengthen its culture.
Almonds are indeed a serious business in Winter's, and we were told that you can tell a Winter's native by the pronunciation of the word. Ammon rhymes with famine. The joke goes that you have to shake the almond trees so hard to get the nuts to fall that you shake the L right out of the ammon. Almonds and agriculture are serious business for even the children growing up in Winter's. At Winter's High School, nearly half the students are enrolled in agriculture classes. The options include an intro course in the history, economics, and production of California agriculture, ag business and management, farm practices and operations, including how to use and manage the machinery, animal and plant science. Lots of kids participate in the Future Farmers of America, FFA, with programs that incorporate public speaking, report writing, parliamentary procedure, and agriculture leadership training. Students in floriculture were already creating arrangements for a local business's Christmas party. On a whiplash rainy December day, I visited the school's off-campus ag site, just a few blocks from the main high school, which is next door to the public library and the town's swimming pool. The big warehouse space abuts the farm fields that were so soggy from the downpours of the so-called Pineapple Express roaring through the region, the beginning of what turned into at least a temporary respite from the years of drought, that we had to postpone our walking tour for a drier day. The students grow tomatoes, pumpkins, ryegrass, grapes, peaches, and plums. Next year, with the help and guidance of local farmers, they planned to start an almond orchard. Inside the dry building, a group of freshmen was busy making black walnut and maple cutting boards, of which many would probably find their way under winter's Christmas trees later that month. Back at the high school, I talked with half a dozen upperclassmen in the school's small cafeteria about life in their small town, their school, and their families. They came from a variety of socioeconomic beginnings and upbringings, children of custodians and professors, of fruit packers, warehouse workers, librarians, mechanics, corrections officers, and managers. Some knew exactly what their parents did for a living, and others weren't quite sure of the companies where their parents worked. Some lived in blended families, others not. They were of means or of very little means. Some were first-generation Americans, and other families went very far back. As in many California farming communities, the population of Winters is roughly half Latino. The median income here and in surrounding Yolo County is just at average level for the United States. That makes it higher than many other areas in California's Central Valley, but much lower than much of the San Francisco Bay Area. There were just 500 kids in the high school. Most of them have been in school together since kindergarten. Not surprisingly, they talked about how they had bonded as a community of classmates after all these years. They said their knowing one another so well, all the foibles and moments, good and bad, has made them close and accepting of one another. Their comments on one of the hot-button issues in American education culture struck me. If the occasional bullying comes up, they told me, the students take initiative themselves to stop it in its tracks with what they described as a, we don't do this here, self-monitoring. I asked about the occasional arrival of new students among their tight-knit classes, wondering how that might work out. They told me that it was a real event when a new student showed up. We love them. We fight to be their friend. Being teenagers, the kids sharpened a wry sense of small-town life as they recited changes over the years. It was a big deal when they took out the blinking light and replaced it with a stoplight, one described, detailing the well-attended ceremony. And Dollar General is coming, and a hotel. There used to be cool things here, another said, and they all added to the bygone list, a train, a movie theater, bowling. The students admitted they knew their lives had been sheltered. And anticipating leaving for college soon, they spoke with a kind of push-pull tension. They would be eager to go, but they knew it would be hard to leave. They wanted to get away, but they could imagine a day when they might want to return. The sequel to this thread came up repeatedly in our conversations with the next older generation of Winters residents, some of whom had indeed returned to start new businesses. We also heard compliments to the storyline from a number of young spouses who married into Winters families and are now raising their own families there. If you fall in love with someone from Winters, be forewarned that you'll probably end up settling in Winters.
We came across two stories of entrepreneurs in Winters, which illustrated two paths forward for a community like this. Russ Lester is just a farmer. John Pickerel is just a restaurant owner. but each has adjusted his business practices and his efforts in the community toward the goal of making their community sustainable in economic, environmental, and social terms. Russ Lester, a nut tree farmer, was born in the 1950s in a part of the state then famous for its fruit and nut orchards and now known as the Silicon Valley. The Santa Clara Valley, where we had our farms, was known for its incredible prunes and apricots and cherries and was called the Valley of Heart's Delight, he told us, when we visited him and his daughter on their walnut farm outside Winters. Obviously, that's all changed. It kind of looks like L.A. now. Lester is a stockily built balding man with an inviting smile, who wore blue jeans, running shoes, and a California Surf Shop t-shirt as he walked us through the orchards. Even as the tech industry arose around him through the 1960s and 1970s, Lester's father resisted selling the family's land, but he could resist only so long. Property taxes kept going up as adjoining properties became semiconductor factories, houses, and office complexes, and so did the family's burden of debt. We were getting taxed at developed land levels, and we were growing prunes, cherries, walnuts, and apricots, Russ Lester said. With several other farming families, the Lesters finally decided to pool their land in Cupertino and sell it and develop it for what first became a mall named Valco Park, which included a large mall named Valco Fashion Mall, now defunct, and has become ground zero for the world's tech industries. Right in the middle of where Apple's world headquarters is now, that's where I used to grow sweet corn that we sold at a roadside stand, Lester said. I try not to go down there anymore. I'm not anti-technology, but I think we have to eat before we play with our computers, and that we need to use our natural resources wisely. With the money from the sale, the Lesters moved north to the Winters area. In 1979, Russ Lester and his wife Kathy, in their mid-20s, bought 68 acres of neglected orchard that they began replanting with walnut trees. As a young person working and living in the Cupertino and Santa Clara orchards, Lester and the rest of his family had been exposed to pesticides, herbicides, chemical fertilizers, and the other components of industrialized agriculture. After their move to Winters, he and his wife decided to switch to sustainable and organic practices. In the 1980s, his father was diagnosed with a form of lymphoma that had been linked to herbicide exposure. Although research couldn't directly link my dad's cancer to the chemicals used in his prune orchards, watching his disease progress made me reconsider even the few pesticides that we still used, Lester wrote in a statement of principles on his company's website. My wife and I decided, for our young family's health, to take the next step. My father's death in 1989 marked the end of our use of conventional chemicals. The resulting operation, known as Dixon Ridge Farms, now covering more than 1,400 acres, attracts visitors from around the world and has been honored by the California state government for its commitment to sustainability and use of energy, water, chemicals, and other components. Conventional farming uses a lot of chemicals, Russ Lester said. With organic farming, you can use hardly any of those chemicals. And then you have sustainable organic farming. My definition of sustainable farming means that we should be able to keep on doing what we're doing today, producing good, healthy food pretty much forever. We're trying to limit the inputs from off-farm and limit our impact on the environment. For water use, the Lester approach involves not tilling the ground between the trees, but instead planting legumes and clover. The resulting 2-foot-high cover crop, plus walnut shell mulch and twigs and prune branches, reduces evaporation. Water is applied through an unusual irrigation system that utilizes low-pressure rotary sprinklers suspended from hoses snaked through the trees, a process that minimizes waste and allows the cover crop to grow over the entire surface. Many walnut and almond growers pull out and replant their trees roughly every 25 years. We have trees that are over 110 years old, Lester said. With the shorter cycles, it's like walnuts on steroids. They produce a lot, and then they peter out, as you would if you were on steroids. You have to rip them out. If you manage them correctly, they can grow for a long, long time and still produce an excellent crop. And you're sequestering a lot of carbon in the trees themselves, creating a stable, healthy environment for various critters. Probably the most celebrated aspect of Dixon Ridge Farms is its use of the byproducts from one walnut crop to create energy for processing the next. Drying and processing nuts after harvest requires a lot of energy. Dixon Ridge has been a pioneer in using the shells and other byproducts of the harvest to create both heat and electricity to operate the farm. Lester said that his farm has produced more than 1,750,000 kilowatt hours of electricity, worth more than $263,000, and will save more than 20,000 gallons of propane per year. Putting the charred shells back into the ground had additional benefits in carbon sequestration. Where does this go next? Lester, a third-generation farmer, has five children. He said, "Farmers are getting older. Farms are getting bigger. If you wanted to get started in farming and had no farm roots, it would be very hard." But we walked the land with his daughter, Jenny, who said that she hoped to continue the tradition. John Pickerel of the Buckhorn Steakhouse is an anchor of Winters' commerce and tourism. He grew up in a cowboy family and looks the part. He was in his early 60s when we met him in Winters, but appeared much younger. Compact, lean, with a full head of sandy hair and a goatee. It's easy to believe that he was a wrestler in high school and college. He spent his childhood in the upper Mountain West, Idaho, Montana, eastern Washington and Oregon, where his father was a rodeo bull rider, then a cattle buyer, then a feedlot operator, then a long-haul livestock trucker, among other pursuits. Pickerel was introduced early to the world of livestock and to the practicalities of how to make a farming-related business pay off. I'd ride with my dad on these long drives, like between Spokane and Montana, and he would tell me all his ideas about business, Pickerel told me, as he led a walking tour of the storefronts near his restaurant. He would say, "John, it's not about how you sell the cows, but how you buy the cows." He'd explain how you needed to think about quality and cost. Ever since then, Pickerel said, he has viewed the commercial landscape around him as an endless series of puzzles. He hears of a new store opening up in town, and immediately thinks, "Show me where the customers will come from. Show me how you're going to make it." He visits a bar or restaurant anywhere else and thinks, "What makes it worth customers coming here?" Pickerel asked himself the same questions when he arrived in Winters in 1980 in his late 20s. By then, he had already started a restaurant in a larger town nearby. "I decided to open a restaurant in Winters because I'd heard this was a place that people would actually travel to if you gave them a good reason," he told me. "But when I came here," he said, "I could see the bones and the charm, and I'd heard that people actually enjoyed driving to Winters. Driving west from Sacramento or Davis, or east from the vast Bay Area, much of the ride would be on relatively quiet roads, through orchards or between hillsides and valleys. So I thought, what if the drive itself added value to the experience they had, and making the experience of the restaurant something they would value and come back for?" Pickerel said that his rule of thumb was you need to have 2 hours' worth of activity for each hour it takes customers to get there. "That's been my mantra for every day since then. How can we add value that makes the trip to this place worthwhile?" For Pickerel, that value came from the now popular cut of meat known as the char-roasted tri-tip that he claims originated at the Buckhorn in the 1980s. Pickerel's business success has spread far beyond Winters. By the late 1990s, he had opened Buckhorn Grills in 10 other cities, while still basing himself in Winters. In 2009, two of his tri-tip grills opened in